This morning, we are talking about another one of the wild and crazy stories in the Bible. It's a story about Abraham and Isaac, and timeline-wise, it's about 4,000 years ago. Now remember, when we look at history, we can barely know what happened 300 years ago. We even worse for 1,500 years ago. Starts getting 2,000 years ago, boom, it gets tougher. Then 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago, and all of history is kind of reduced to little things that we find in the sand and drawings on walls, right? So remember, when we're looking at Old Testament stuff, the guidelines that we have that are in your bulletin, and if you haven't downloaded that yet, go to lovewestbrook.org. For some of you, I had somebody say, that's tough for me to remember. I said, well, you can also get there by fbcwestbrook.com or fbcwestbrook.org, whichever is easiest to remember. But that's our website. Now, that's different for those of you who are like, this internet thing is still a puzzle, and you think Facebook is our website, or you think this. No, no, there's a whole other world. And your website is kind of like your little file cabinet, your library of everything that's going on. So on our website, we have everything from this building's history all the way back to 1888 and when Scottish immigrants built it. But anyway, go on that website, lovewestbrook.org, and download the bulletin. Just click on it and it'll download and you can read right along. Going to need that today, because what we're doing in looking for parallels and foreshadowing in this 4,000-year-old story to Jesus coming later is, it's kind of hard to track or to stay with, okay? So we're going to do our best to try to do that. I'll have some slides. You can feel free. Take out your phone. Take a picture. We're not afraid of phones. We're not afraid of any of that stuff. But here's the story. Abraham and Isaac. I'll give you some of the background from the Bible Project with a little video in a second. But this story here, Abraham's promised son. Abraham and Sarah are too old for babies, way too old. Sarah has been barren. She's never had a child. God promises you're going to have a child. We get God's promise fulfilled. He has Isaac. Isaac is that promise. He is the loved, incredible gift of God. And then the story we're going to read about today in Genesis 22. I want you to grab that Bible up in front of you. The paperback one is the New Living Translation, which is what we'll be reading along with. Dave is going to spare my voice again when we go there. But you're going to need to keep your finger in that chapter as we go through. So here's Isaac. He's loved. He's the only son. And God says to Abraham, I want you to kill him for me. I want you to sacrifice him for me. Now remember, we talked 2 weeks ago about presentism. We take presentism, the morals and values of today, the standards of today, and we naturally project them back onto history. So we are mortified to think of, say, even 1,400 years ago, of people gathering in a town square to watch a hanging. Right? We look and go, oh, that's called presentism, when we take that emotion, that feeling, everything, and we put it backwards. So we do that with Isaac, Abraham, as well. Just as some groundwork to lay for you, every culture at Abraham's time included human sacrifice to their gods. And I say gods because at that time it was all polytheistic. It was multiple gods, the societies, the cultures, multiple gods, and they did human sacrifice. It was commonplace, all right? So as much as that's horrific to us, and we can't even imagine it, this, for Abraham, that dynamic comes in with worshiping his God. When his God says, I want you to sacrifice your son to me, Abraham didn't react to that the way we would react to that, okay? We're going to watch this little video clip.
The book of Genesis. In the first video, we saw how chapters 1 through 11 set up the basic storyline of the Bible. God has created all things, and he makes humans in his image to rule the world on his behalf. The humans choose sin and rebellion, and so the world spins out of control into violence and death, all leading up to the rebellion and scattering of the people in Babylon. And so the big question is, what is God going to do to rescue and redeem his world? Well, out of that scattering at Babylon, the author traces a genealogy of just one family that leads eventually to a man named Abram, later known as Abraham. And God's promise to Abraham at the beginning of chapter 12 opens up a whole new movement in the story. God calls Abraham to leave his home and go to the land of Canaan, which God says will become his one day. And in that land, God promises to make Abraham into a great nation, to make his name great, and to bless him. Now, these promises are connected back to earlier parts of the book. So Babylon had arrogantly tried to make a great name for itself, and that didn't go over very well. But God, in his generosity, is going to bestow a great name on this no-name guy, Abraham. And God's blessing of Abraham echoes all the way back to that original blessing God gave humanity in the beginning. So the question is, why is God going to bless Abraham and his family? And the last line of God's promise makes this clear. So that all the families of the earth will find God's blessing in you. Now, this is key for understanding the whole rest of the biblical story. God's plan is to rescue and bless his rebellious world through Abraham's family. And this is why the whole rest of the Old Testament story is just going to focus on this one family, eventually called the people of Israel. This is also why Israel will later be called a kingdom of priests at Mount Sinai. God wants to use them to show all of the other nations what he's like. And ultimately, this is the promise that gets picked up by the later biblical prophets and poets who say that its fulfillment will come through Israel's messianic king, whose reign will bring justice and peace to all of the nations. Now, at this point of the story, none of that's clear. You just have to keep reading and watch the promise develop. And so the rest of the book focuses on Abraham and his family. First, Abraham himself, then his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons. And the stories about each generation, they're united by two main themes. So first, each generation of Abraham's family is marked by repeated failure. They just keep making really bad decisions that mess up their lives and that put God's promise in jeopardy. However, God remains faithful to them. He keeps rescuing them from themselves and reaffirming his commitment to bless them and bless the nations through them despite their failings. So the Abraham stories. God had promised Abraham a huge family, but on two different occasions, he's afraid for his life because other men are attracted to his wife, and so he denies that he's even married to her, which creates, of course, all of these problems. And not only that, Abraham and his wife Sarah, they can't have children, and so Sarah arranges for Abraham to sleep with one of their servant girls, which also creates all of these problems in the family. But each time, God bails Abraham out. And in chapters 15 and 17, God even formalizes his promise to Abraham with an official commitment called a covenant. This is a classic scene. God invites Abraham to look up at the night stars and to count them. And he says, that's how numerous your family's going to be. And despite all of the odds, having no kids and no way to have any at the moment, Abraham looks up in the sky and simply trusts God's promise. And God responds by entering into a covenant with Abraham, promising that he will become a father of many nations, that God's blessing may come to the whole world. God asks Abraham to mark his family with a sign of the covenant, circumcision of all the male boys in the family. This is a symbol to remind them that the fruitfulness of their family is a gift from God. And so Abraham has lots of kids eventually, and he dies at a good old age.
So, I mean, Here's the thing. Some of you guys have grown up in churches, or you are you're all in. You're like, yeah, okay, this makes sense. Others of you are looking and going, wait, what? You know, because when you lay out the whole of Scripture and the entire Bible, and you're going through a representation of 6,000 years, 5,000 years of history, and trying to get it all to come to that place, the history starts, it helps to have an overview of where the history is going, okay, and why it's happening, like that circumcision thing. If you trace that back and across the world, and we have 2.5 billion Christians, the majority of the male world is circumcised. And where does that come from? That goes all the way back to Abraham, okay, all the way back. So when we look at this history, we're going to be reading in Genesis 22, and we're going to do the same thing we did last week, with David doing our reading for us and helping me to get my voice to go through. But turn to Genesis chapter 22, and we're going to start right off there.
Sometime later, God tested Abraham's faith. Abraham, God called. Yes, he replied, here I am. Take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah. Go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will show you.
Okay, we're going to stop right there for a second because I want to issue a caution. I want to issue a caution when we look at this and see what's happening. All right? The first thing I just want to point out is that God gave an audible call to Abraham. This wasn't a hunch. It wasn't a feeling. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't any of the... This was an audible call to Abraham. Now, I know parts of our society right now are making it seem... Like, I was listening to a song last night. I forget who it was by, but Robin and I were listening, and I went, wait, what? Because it takes the song, Count Your Blessings, and it basically talks about miracles. Miracles on miracles on miracles, and it just goes on of naming your miracles and your miracles. And it cheapens miracles. It is, who is it? Maverick City Music. So I look at that and I go, wow, that's really bad theology. Great song. Got a good beat, easy to dance to, makes me feel good, but it's not true. Okay? It's just not true. Because God called infrequently in audible voices. God's miracles stand out. When you get all green lights going down William Clark, it's not a miracle. It's just not. And people will be like, oh, it was such a miracle. No, miracle is when God changes the very laws of nature and steps in and makes it go differently. That miracle happens when you go and somebody discovers the cancer they had is totally gone without that treatment. With treatment, it's God's providential care, okay, because God has given us the medicine, all right? So I want to make that point, that God called audibly to Abraham. So we have times in our society where people will say, they'll do things, they'll shoot people, they'll do weird, they'll do awful things and say, and the news loves to play the headline, you know, guy who blew up this says God told him to do it. It's God. This is not Abraham hearing a voice in his head. This is not any of that. It's not a hunch. It's not a feeling. Oh, I just feel led. That's not what's happening here. That's legitimate. You can feel led. As a matter of fact, when we go back to when I was in youth ministry, I would have people come into my office and say they wanted to volunteer to work with the youth group. And I would say, ah, cool. Why? What is it? The ones who would say, God told me to, I'd go, wait a minute. Explain that a little bit. How did that happen? Did you hear? And it would usually come like this. I just feel like God is telling me to do this. Want me to tell you something? I normally found those people less reliable because they would just feel like God told them to do something else 3 months later after their first outing with middle schoolers. It's like, my feelings a lot of times are that during this time of year, that God is calling us to plant a church in Costa Rica. You know, certain things happen, and I'm like, ah, I feel that calling. This was an audible voice to Abraham. Okay, let's continue on.
The next morning, Abraham got up early. He saddled his donkey and took two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac. Then he chopped wood for a fire for a burnt offering and set out to the place God had told him about. On the third day of their journey, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Stay here with the donkey, Abraham told the servants. The boy and I will travel a little further. We will worship there, and then we will come back and come right back.
We will come back is an interesting thing. We will come back. He's going to sacrifice his son, and he says, we will come back. Theologians and historians have different ideas of what this is. That's not a surprise. When I went to seminary, it was 92% arguing. You know, with who says this and what, you know. So it's not a surprise. There are different ideas of why he said we. Some people believe and say he said we because he was so confident that God was going to resurrect him, his son, or do something that he really didn't have to worry about this. He was not going to lose Isaac. Other people say, no, he was saying we, so the servants didn't freak out and Isaac didn't freak out. Which do you tend to believe? I tend to believe that he said we for the benefit of the servants and for Isaac. Because otherwise, I look at the degree of that sacrifice. If Abraham was just thinking, hey, God is going to work it all up out and I'll still have Isaac anyway, he would have gone into it whistling. Hey, woohoo, okay, let's go sacrifice my son because it really doesn't mean anything. Because he's going to give him to me back. So I look at that and my leaning is not toward his confidence in the we that God is going to give him what he wants. Kind of a different way, right? For many of us, we've heard it taught that we means, oh, he was so sure that God would never ask him to do this. Remember presentism. Remember context of history. Gods in every culture at that time requested sacrifice and followed through on it. The other thing I point out in that is that saying on the third day, how far away was Mount Moriah? Was it a three-day journey? Did they go extra slow? What was happening there? And if you research and you look back at studying the Old Testament, and you study in particular what Jews will write about the Torah, they will tell you that in the Torah, that expression, the third day, was more an expression of emphasis, of significance. And you will find this several other places in the Old Testament. And on the third day, this happened. And on the third day, meaning, look, here it is. This is a big deal thing. Not necessarily that it took 3 days. Now remember, our look at history is what? We want 3 days to be 3 days. People are always saying to me, Jesus rose on the third day, but by my calculations, he was only in the grave less than 48 hours. And I say, well, that's true from our history perspective, but in the Sabbath perspective, it's day one Friday, day two Saturday, day three Sunday. So we look at history and remember this is a theological history. But we'll come back to that we thing. Let's keep going.
So Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders while he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them walked on together, Isaac turned to Abraham and said, Father? Yes, my son, Abraham replied. We have the fire and the wood, the boy said, but where is the sheep for the burnt offering? God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son, Abraham answered, and they both walked on together.
God will provide that lamb. God will provide the lamb for the offering. The wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders. That says something about the age of Isaac. Obviously, he wasn't a toddler. He wasn't a 10-year-old. He was most likely a teenager. Let's keep going.
When they arrived at the place where God had told them to go, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. Then he tied his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on the top of the wood. And Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son as a sacrifice. At that moment, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Yes, Abraham replied, here I am. Don't lay a hand on the boy, the angel said. Do not hurt him in any way, for now I know that you truly fear God. You have not withheld from me even your son, your only son.
You've not withheld even your son, your only son, and we'll finish up here with this part of Genesis 22.
Then Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. So he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering in the place of his son.
And the angel of the Lord called again to Abraham from the heavens. This is what the Lord says, because you have obeyed me and have not withheld even your son, your only son, I swear by my own name that I will certainly bless you. I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies, and through your descendants all the nations of earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me.
All the nations of the earth will be blessed. And when we play out the full story and go through the whole Old Testament and then come to the place where it goes beyond the Jews to the Gentiles as well, having Christ for them, that is where it became all earth. All the nations on the earth will be blessed through a descendant in the line of Abraham. Now, let's look at the parallels. This is kind of like a study type thing. We're going to look at the parallels here in this little chart. Abraham, Jesus. Genesis 22:2 says, sacrifice your only son. So if you're writing it down, you write that part down in there. Sacrifice your only son. This is an obvious parallel, right? This is kind of obvious because we know John 3:16 says what? God loved the world so much, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. His only son. So there's parallel number one. Number two, Genesis 22:2 again says this place, go to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. If you go and you study where Mount Moriah is and where that place where this occurred 4,500 years ago or so, 4,000 years ago, If you look at the place of what Mount Moriah became, Mount Moriah became Jerusalem and is where the Temple Mount is today. So it's the same place, the same area where Jesus was crucified, Mount Moriah. An interesting parallel. The third one, Genesis 22, 6. Isaac has to carry the wood because his dad's too old. He's not going to carry the wood up the mountain. Isaac's carrying the wood. Here's Isaac carrying the wood, not really sure what they're doing, knowing that they're following God's command, trusting his dad, and trusting his dad's God. And so he's carrying the wood on his shoulder, right? Carrying the wood on his shoulder. Somebody read John 19, 17 out loud in a nice loud voice. John 19, 17. It's an interactive part this morning.
So they took Jesus with them, carried the cross by himself, and went to a place called
Golgotha. So he carried on his shoulder what? The cross. Isaac carried the wood. Jesus carried his cross. It's another parallel. Foreshadowing of what's to come several thousand years later. The fourth one, Genesis 22, 7 that Dave read. Dad, where's the lamb for the offering? Where's the sheep? And some people get caught up in this again with the whole history mindset. Well, how come it says ram? How come it says sheep here? How come it says, you know, did they really know? Was it a giraffe? What's going on? What's happening? And again, we're looking for the history in our minds of how history works, and we're not looking for the theological history, which is basically God will provide the animal to sacrifice. God will provide the lamb, sheep, some of your translations say, right? But when he gets to that point, God provided a ram that had its horns stuck in the bushes, okay? Somebody read, besides Holly, John 1:29. Holly is that girl in youth group who always won this Bible drill thing. John 1:29. All right, Steve's got it.
The next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world."
Here's what we have happening. Dad, where's the lamb? Let's jump ahead. Let's jump ahead 2,000 years, 2,500 years, where John the Baptist says, "Behold the Lamb, here's the Lamb. Where's the Lamb? Here's the Lamb. Where's the Lamb? Here's the Lamb." Another parallel or foreshadowing. So it's a lot to write down and look at, but I want you to look at it during this week. So I've put this slide together just so that you can take a picture of it if you want. Grab your phone, take a picture of it, you can look, and then do your own comparison of the parallels through Scripture, okay? Maybe we'll post it on our prayer page as well, just to help you in tracking this. Remember, just because I stand up here and say things doesn't mean you have to agree with me. And I know some of you from a Catholic background, that seems weird, okay? That seems weird. Because I am supposed to say the things and you're not supposed to question them and all that. No. Study for yourself. Be like the Bereans it talks about in Acts chapter 2. Be like the Bereans who were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, because not only did they hear what Paul said, but they studied the Scriptures to see if what Paul said were true. And if you can question Paul, the Apostle Paul, who wrote most of the New Testament, you can certainly question me. And online, if you're in a church where you can't question the guy who's standing up front here, get out of that church. I mean it. I've been in one of those churches. All right. So you got it? So let's look at a few more parallels as we wind down. Genesis 22:8. God will provide the lamb. 1 Peter 1:18 and 19 describes Jesus as the perfect, spotless lamb. Genesis 22:9. Isaac is obedient to his father and his father's God. And then when we look at Matthew 26:39, it's when Jesus said, if there's any way possible to let this cup pass from me so I don't have to do it, let's do that. But Father, not my will, but yours. So there's obedience to the Father for difficult things in both situations. And lastly, when we look at Hebrews 11:9, we see that Isaac was resurrected figuratively. Isaac was resurrected figuratively. Abraham expected to leave there without Isaac. Unfair, terrible. But if God commanded it, he was like, okay, God has commanded it. But he returned with his son, who he expected to be dead, so he was resurrected figuratively. And then we see in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 15:4, it says this: Jesus was buried and he raised from the dead on the third day, just as the scriptures said. So here's that next one to take a picture of and fill out if you'd like, or to look for it this week on our prayer page so you can study and dig a little deeper. And I wanted to look at this, what Jesus said in John 8. It's kind of strange. Your father Abraham rejoiced as he looked forward to my coming. Because all the Jews knew, and they called him Father Abraham. The Kelly family will sing Father Abraham. Yeah, and go through every stinking verse all the time. You can be in a half-hour worship thing and be like, does anybody have any songs they'd like to sing? One of the Kellys would be like, Father Abraham, no, we don't have time. But they would look and say, we are descendants of Abraham. So he is our father. Your father Abraham rejoiced as he looked forward to my coming. He saw it and was glad. Wait a minute. How did Abraham see it? How did Abraham see and look forward to the coming of Jesus? That was 2,000 years earlier. What on earth does Jesus mean here? Well, Jesus is saying that, number one, Abraham saw it because he who has seen me has seen the Father. So he's known that. I am is still I am. He's seen that. But he has seen God's plan when the lamb was given as the substitute for the sacrifice, as the substitute for Isaac. He saw it then. That's when he saw it and was glad. So Abraham wasn't shocked. We get shocked. And we read the story of God telling a man to sacrifice his son, his only son, and we're shocked. How could God dare? How could God, a loving God, ask man to do that? Supposedly he loves this man. He's going to ask him to do that. That's ridiculous. That's not a loving God. That can't be. That can't be. But Abraham wasn't shocked. He trusted that God was God. God had a plan. And somehow, God would be glorified. And that was what was most important. But that shock, how dare he? Why doesn't that shock transfer with us? Why doesn't that shock transfer with us to what Jesus did. Why aren't we mortified that God gave up his only son as a substitute for us? Remember last week we looked and we all admitted when somebody sins against us, we want them to pay. Drunk driver kills our daughter, we want them to pay. Somebody steals everything in our house, we want them to pay. We all admitted that we want that. And yet we stand back and say, how can God say that he wants, that sin against him and there needs to be payment for it? How can God do that? I thought he should just let it all go. Well, you let it all go too, okay? God had to deal with that sin problem. And he did let it all go when he paid the price by providing the lamb. The substitute. The perfect lamb. When we look at Noah, we know, was Noah a perfect guy? No. The Bible calls him righteous for the people in his time. Was Abraham a perfect guy? No, you saw some of the story. Imagine this, I'm a little scared. My wife is attractive. I'm a little scared because the king is taking an interest in my wife. And he might bump me off to get my wife. So I go, no, she's my sister. Here, go ahead. What? I'm like, what? You kidding me? No, Abraham wasn't a perfect guy, but he loved God, and he was put in this situation. So as the music team comes up to close us today, see, the stories in the Old Testament are wild, and I don't pretend to understand all the hows, the whys, the whens, the wheres. I don't pretend to know them inside and out. But I see the same God who made the promises throughout that he would rescue, and he did rescue. He rescued by saying, come and enter into the ark. That was the rescue, into the ark. And then in this story, come, here it is, sacrifice that must be given to appease me, to please me. Here it is, you make that sacrifice, and you must pay it. But wait a minute, get yourself out of that picture, because I am going to put my only son there and have him suffer. Some people are like, big deal, he knew he was going to raise him from the dead. People who say that haven't almost died. People who say that haven't experienced pain to the degree that Jesus experienced pain. People would say to me in my transplant process, they'd say, Scott, you don't have to be afraid to die. I'd say, I'm not afraid of being dead. I'm afraid of the process. And he said, okay, you get off of that altar that you deserve, and I'm going to put my son there to pay your price so that we can be together. So next week, we're going to look at another wild story. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which until I was probably 12, I thought is the last one was to bed we go. We're going to look at their story. It's another wild one. And how they were rescued in the middle of the hottest time they had ever been in. We're going to look at that. But you guys, I see Jesus, the final rescue throughout all these stories. It's the same God, the same story, the same God is still faithful to us as he's always been and always will be. We'll close this morning.